Welcome, this is Marco. You're listening to Astra Talk on CITR 101.9. This is the show for Thursday, November 26th. I'm going to talk a little bit about planets first. And of course, as I always talk about, when I watch BBC Earth, I gain a lot of information. And it's fun because you don't have to read, you just listen. So another show came on about planets, and it talked a little bit about Jupiter, but basically the main theme of this show was how planets form, where they form, how come they end up where they end up. And this relates to something I talked about a few weeks ago about Jupiter. And I always thought before, I would never think otherwise. And I think what happened with a discovery in 2015, it dazzled scientists because astronomers, because they started discovering types of stars that were in places where they didn't think they would be. So these were called hot Jupiters. They're big planets. Some of them are bigger than Jupiter, quite a bit bigger than Jupiter. And the amazing thing about these hot Jupiters, that's what they were called, hot Jupiters, is they orbit very close to their star. So these are exoplanets that scientists have been looking at, and it's been a puzzling result because it turned out that it challenged some of the things that scientists thought were truths, and they had to rethink these. So I talked about Jupiter in our solar system, and it took about, I believe this is what those scientists said, it took about 5 million years for Jupiter form. And a planet like the Earth, they said it took about 100 million years. And Jupiter formed in the beginning of the solar system when the sun was just starting to shine. And it wasn't as powerful as it was later on. So this was the key thing. And one of the things the scientists did, they took a piece of dry ice and he held it in his hand with a glove and he brought it close to a fire. And as soon as the dry ice was brought close to the fire, it started melting and vaporizing. So because of this, because of Jupiter's core being ice, scientists believe that gas giants had to form in the outer reaches of the solar system, not close to the star. So now they're finding a lot of hot Jupiters close to stars, and they're wondering why. Because there was all these beliefs before. I think one of them was that gas giants could not be close to their stars because the ice cores, they had to form outside, in the outside parts of their solar system. And that's what apparently scientists said happened to Jupiter. If it tried to form close to the sun, the sun would have melted at ice core and it probably would never have formed. So again, what Brian Cox said, this is what I repeated a few weeks ago, was that Jupiter started to migrate into the inner solar system. So he said, he didn't tell why or how it did that or what caused it to start to migrate. But these scientists that I listened to the show, it was last night, they said there was still a lot of gas and dust in the solar system. So that's what pushed Jupiter in. So I'm not exactly sure, but that's what they said. So when Brian Cox talked about these things, it was more like absolute truth. When he speaks, he says, this is this, this is that, and that's the truth. But these scientists were saying, well, we're not sure. So this is what their theory was, that Jupiter moved in because of the gas and the dust pushed it in. So I guess it was something that I said before, where Jupiter interfered with Mars, accreting more matter and becoming bigger. And of course, I said before that Saturn also started moving into the inner solar system. So this is relevant because other exoplanets that they've discovered, like these hot Jupiters, they're close to their stars. So they believe that these exoplanets, these hot Jupiters, formed in the outer parts of their solar system and then started to move in. So Jupiter moved in and Saturn moved in. And what I got from the show last night was that somehow Jupiter and Saturn got into an orbital resonance. So they were attracted and they started to orbit close to each other. That's what they basically said. So something then caused Jupiter and Saturn to move out. So these I guess you can call them facts. In a way, it's a theory because we weren't there, or we didn't see it. But then when the scientists gather all the facts together, that's what they conclude. So they think that Jupiter and Saturn moved in, then they moved out. So what caused this, and then what caused them to remain in stable orbits, they don't say. Then somehow Uranus and Neptune also somehow formed, and what they were saying is that Jupiter flung them out into the outer reaches of the solar system. So Jupiter was the big force that carved out our solar system, and this is what Brian Cox says too. So now we have stable orbits, and as I said before, Mercury, scientists believe it was at the orbit of Mars, then it moved in, and then it stabilized in its orbit now, which is an elliptical orbit. And Mercury is kind of strange because its day, I believe, is twice as long as its year. So logically, I don't want to explain that because I'll get all brain tied, so I'm not going to explain it. But there's lots of things about planet formation that scientists that were being challenged when scientists started discovering a lot of exoplanets in the outer parts of the solar system. Exoplanets in other solar systems. So there was the hot Jupiters is one of the main things. So that was another example that I can tell you that planetary science, a lot of the scientists now are not sure what happens because there's different planets and different orbits and different solar systems. So the hot Jupiters are an example of a planet where scientists don't think it should be, because if it formed close to their star, the star would have melted its ice core. It would never had the chance to accrete, gather all the gas. So they believe the hot Jupiters formed in the outer parts of their solar systems. They're halfway through. And then they also migrated in, so they're orbiting at that point. And another thing that the program last night on BBC Earth talked about was the asteroid belt in here, and somehow Jupiter had the biggest role in forming the asteroid belt the way it is now. So apparently there's two parts of the asteroid belt that are very close together. There's the rocky part, that's the inner part, it faces towards the sun, and the icy part, which faces away from the sun, so it's on the other side of the rocky part. So these two parts are very close together, and scientists aren't sure how come these two, rocky and icy, form so close together, but there's a ring of rocky debris, and then there's a ring of icy debris. So apparently Jupiter had a role in forming that the way that it did. So there was 4 points that they brought up about Jupiter last night, and you know what, I didn't make notes, I didn't tape it, I can't remember, but two of them were the divide between the asteroid belt, the rocky and the icy part, and the reason that Mars is the way it is, smaller, like 1/10 the mass of the Earth, and also that planets move. Something that I guess scientists believe didn't happen before. So there's, of course, there's no way to know, but there's all these clues that scientists piece together. For example, when some kind of planetoid hit our Earth, hit the young Earth, there was a lot of debris that went up into the atmosphere or past the atmosphere, and then it coalesced and it formed the moon. So that happened many millions or billions of years ago, and scientists could not see that happening, but that's what they conclude from their theories. So this was very interesting what these scientists were talking about, how Jupiter is the most important planet in our solar system, and it keeps on being the most important planet in our solar system. And the way the solar system is carved out now, it's Jupiter did the carving. Another thing they talked about the show, this was the same show, but it almost seems like a totally different topic. They talked about how life formed on Earth and how maybe life could form in other parts of our universe. And different than what Brian Cox talked about. Brian Cox talked about the proton gradient, this it happens in our cells right now. There's a proton gradient, and this is what powers the cell. And the proton gradient is the thing that gave the energy to cells, and says without the proton gradient, life could not exist. So these scientists didn't talk about the proton gradient. They talked about, yes, they did talk about there has to be an energy source to fuel the growth of the cell, but they didn't talk about the proton gradient. They talked more about the biological aspects of things. Different than what Brian Cox talks about when he talks about physics. So he basically says, if it's a physical law, if it's a physical process, this will then happen in other parts of maybe the solar system or other parts of our galaxy or other parts of the universe or other galaxies far away. And so it's a scientific process. So that's why he thinks that there is life, because when life blooms into existence, it's just because it's following the physical laws that are forcing it to behave the way that, forcing these cells to behave the way that they behave. So again, if you have a chance to see BBC Earth or other things, there's very, really, really good shows, and it really increases your knowledge about just astronomy in general. So what am I going to talk about now? I'm going to talk about a brown dwarf. So what happened is there is lots of brown dwarfs outside our solar system. I contacted NASA. I am part of their OSIRIS-REx, so I'm an ambassador, but because of COVID-19, I haven't been able to give any presentations. But I also joined another group which searches for brown dwarfs. And what they wanted, I thought they would somehow provide data, because that's what they do sometimes for citizen scientists. They provide data, and then the citizen scientists comb through the data and make a lot of discoveries, and they really help NASA out, so NASA doesn't have to dedicate all this man hours to these things. So I joined the Brown Dwarf Project, hoping to look for brown dwarfs, but what happened is they wanted you to have a telescope and a camera apparatus. I think it's called a CCD. I didn't, so I couldn't join it. But apparently, when I joined that, I read up on it, and there's a lot of brown dwarfs floating around out there that we don't know that they're there. So what is a brown dwarf? I guess you can call it a failed star, an object that didn't have enough mass to get enough, I guess, the gravity when a cloud of dust collapses in on itself and all this mass gathers together. That's what happened with our star, with our sun. It created enough pressure, and the gravity squeezed things enough to raise the temperature high enough to have nuclear fusion begin. So what happens with a brown dwarf? It doesn't have enough mass. So in a way, I've read before that our planet Jupiter is in a way a failed star, because if it could have gotten like 20 times bigger or 30 times bigger or 30 times more mass, it could have had enough mass to squeeze it hard enough to begin nuclear fusion. So I guess that's what a brown dwarf is, a failed star. A body with a lot of helium. It's like a Jupiter, bigger and smaller than a star. So I'm going to read this article now about a super planet. It could be a brown dwarf. This is on LifeScience.com. And this is, today I'm doing this show on Tuesday, November 2025. So this will air, November 24th. So right now it's November 24th. So this is when the article came out. And this program will air on the 26th. So the name of the article is Faint Superplanet Discovered by Radio Telescope for the First Time. And I thought that was really cool what I talked about last time, and what Brian Cox said was that there's the cosmic microwave background, the echoes of the Big Bang. It's apparently all around us. And if we could vision things in microwave light, then the night wouldn't be dark anymore, because there would be microwave beams flying all over the place and we could see light. So apparently we cannot see it because we don't have radio or X-ray vision. So well, that's kind of cool how some things are visioned in radio or x-rays or gamma rays, and then they piece these all together with visible x-ray, gamma ray, or whatever, and then we can see more beautiful things. So this article is called Faint Superplanet Discovered by Radio Telescope for the First Time. So here's an artist's illustration. It's of a new brown dwarf, BDR. Oh, I just learned that. A brown dwarf is called BDR. And this one is BDR J1750 plus 38029, or Elegast. This faint, cold celestial body was detected using radio telescope observations for the first time. I think astronomy's grand. There's so many cool things about astronomy. Okay, I'm going to read the article. So again, the article is Faint Superplanet Discovered by Radio Telescope for the First Time. So it's looks like a reddish, kind of a Jupiter, but more reddish with streaks, yellow and white streaks, and there's some magnetic field lines coming out of the poles. Okay, scientists have discovered a cold, faint superplanet that has remained elusive to traditional infrared survey methods. Observations from the Low Frequency Array, or LOFAR radio telescope, revealed a brown dwarf, which researchers have designated BDR J1750 plus 3809, a nickname Elegast. Brown dwarfs are sometimes referred to as failed stars or superplanets because they are too small to be considered stars, yet too big to be considered planets. So that would be interesting to think if, let's say, if somehow Jupiter formed and it kept forming and it kept accreting mass, and all of a sudden it had enough material to start nuclear fusion, so our solar system would have had two stars. So it's pretty sure that our Earth probably would not have survived. So I wonder how planets can survive in multiple star systems, but apparently more than 50%, I don't know the exact percentage, but more than 50% of planetary systems have two stars in them. So generally, brown dwarfs are discovered by infrared sky surveys. Elegast, however, represents the first substellar object to be detected. I like that word, substellar. Substellar object to be detected using a radio telescope, according to a statement from the University of Hawaii. Related, brown dwarfs, strange failed stars of the universe explained. Okay, so one thing I did do was when I did go to Hawaii, I regret I didn't plan the trip better, but if I ever do, I will go this time with better plans, because there's the University of Hawaii, of course, and then there's the Department of Astronomy, and the Department of Astronomy, I believe it's all located on the big island of Hawaii. That's where all these telescopes are, and I didn't get to go to the University of Hawaii. It was, again, around Christmas. I'm not sure. No. It was the end of summer, so there weren't a lot of professors. It wasn't during COVID, but there was professors on leave, and I could have seen a tour of the telescope up in the mountain, but I got there a bit too late, so next time I'll plan it better. But I did see the Milky Way, and it was great at night. Okay, so it says Michael Liu, co-author of the study and researcher from the University of Hawaii Institute of Astronomy, said in a statement. This is quote, this work opens a whole new method to finding the coldest objects floating in the sun's vicinity, which would otherwise be too faint to discover with a method used for the past 25 years, end quote. Since brown dwarfs are too small to become stars, they don't undergo the same nuclear fusion reactions that fuel bright stars, like our sun. Therefore, they are smaller, dimmer, and colder than normal stars, making them harder to find using conventional methods such as infrared instruments. However, brown dwarfs can emit light at radio wavelengths. So again, a couple of weeks ago, I learned about black dwarfs. So these are dwarfs, or these are stars at the end of the solar system, when everything burns itself out and all you have is black embers. You know, I don't have anything. So we have white dwarfs, black dwarfs, and brown dwarfs. The researchers first discovered Elegast using the LOFAR radio telescope based in the Netherlands. Their observations were then later confirmed using the International Gemini Observatory in Hawaii and Chile and the NASA Infrared Telescope facility, which is operated by the University of Hawaii. We asked ourselves, why point our radio telescope at catalog brown dwarfs? Flerish Vendentham, lead author of the study, said in a statement, "Let's just make a large image of the sky and discover these objects directly in the radio." Okay, so that's cool. They just took the whole sky and mapped it in radio rather than just pointing at little spots. So using the LOFAR instruments to detect Ella gas represents an innovative approach that could help scientists discover other celestial objects, such as gas giant exoplanets, that are too cold or faint to be detected by infrared surveys, according to the statement. The new research was published November 9th in the Astrophysical Journal Letters. Okay, so this is something they called, at the beginning they called it a brown dwarf. And that, no, first they called it a superplanet, now they call it a brown dwarf. So I guess a superplanet is the same as a brown dwarf, because it's a gas, a ball of gas, and it didn't have enough matter for it to squeeze the innards hard enough with enough pressure to create enough temperature for it to ignite in nuclear fusion. Okay, so what I'm going to do now, I'm going to go for a break. So thank you for listening. When we come back, we're going to talk more astronomy with Marco on CITR, with AstroTalk, with Marco on CITR 101.9.
Are you interested in human rights and social justice? Come check out Amnesty International UBC. We fight to stop human rights violations all over the world, including here in Canada. Our club hosts letter writing sessions, social events, documentary nights, bar fundraisers, and current events discussions on a bi-weekly basis. So keep your ears open and check out our Amnesty International UBC Facebook page for more information. We look forward to promoting human rights with you.
Accessibility,
disability, mental health,
ADHD and ADD,
and many, many more topics we explore and cover.
But where?
On CITR's All Access Pass.
A unique and collectively run show on equity, inclusion, and creating awareness for people of all abilities in BC and around the world.
Catch us every other Wednesday afternoon from 3 to 4. If you want more info or want to get involved, please find us on Facebook or send us an email at accessibilitycollective@citr.ca.
Welcome back. This is Marco. You're listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9. So I just finished talking about a brown dwarf that they found. And with this exoplanet research, there's so many ways they can link things in astronomy. So I never heard a brown dwarf be called a superplanet, but that's what they're calling it. So they're calling it both a brown dwarf and a superplanet. So I guess what would have happened in our solar system if Jupiter would have accumulated enough mass to undergo nuclear fusion? So what happens is, if it was much smaller than the Sun, then it would have burned for billions of years more than the Sun would have burned. So in Proxima Centauri, the next closest stellar system, I believe they have three stars, and they're smaller than the Sun. So what I recall is that one of them will last for about 20 billion years, the other one will last for 40 billion, and the other one will shine for 60 billion. So the smaller a star is, the longer it lasts. And of course, things aren't always linear, because you think, okay, if something's twice as big, it will last half as long. That's not necessarily so. When a star is bigger, it burns itself quicker because of all the pressure. It burns super fast. So because our Sun is supposed to, let's just give the figure, it could be anywhere between 10 to 12 billion years, but let's say it's 12 billion years. So now you get another star that's twice as big as the Sun. We can't linearly extrapolate and say that star will burn for 6 billion. It could burn for a lot less. So these things are not linear relations in terms of how fast the star would burn in terms of its light. So the inverse square law operates in that way. So if I have my camera and I focus on a spot, I take a picture. Then I increase something by 2. That means there's 1 over 2 squared, 1 over r squared, would be the amount of light that would come in, the amount of sharpness. So it would decrease by a factor of 4, so 1 over 4. So many things obey the inverse square law. And when you have things like stars with a volume, I get, believe it's volume equals 4 over 3 pi r cubed. When you have a much bigger star, it's something, the radius is cubed, so it doesn't necessarily mean a star that's twice as big will last half as long. It could last 1/8 as long, because r cubed is 2 times 2 times 2 is 8. So it could last 1/8 the time. We don't know. Or there's probably scientists out there that know, but I don't know. But anyway, there's not linear relationships in a lot of these things. So the next thing I'm going to go to is an article on livescience.com. It's called Solar Power Stations in Space Could Be the Answer to Our Energy Needs. So energy, of course, is what we're all about on this planet. We need energy to survive, to run our car, to watch TV, to power my microphone right now. And guess what? I'm watching Green Acres while I'm doing this. And there's Arnold the Pig. So Arnold the Pig is causing trouble. Isn't it cool? We have Arnold the Pigs on our planet. So now I'm going to talk about solar power stations in space could be the answer to our energy needs. This is on livescience.com. It's by Amanda Jane Hughes and Stephanie Soldini. It was published 3 days ago, so that would be 21st of November. So here is a artist's conception of a solar-powered satellite dubbed the Integrated Symmetrical Concentrator SPS concept. It sounds like science fiction. Giant solar power stations floating in space that beam down enormous amounts of energy to Earth. And for a long time, the concept first developed by the Russian scientist Konstantin Tsiolkovsky in the 1920s was mainly an inspiration for writers. A century later, however, scientists are making huge strides in turning the concept into reality. The European Space Agency has realized the potential of these efforts and is now looking to fund such projects, predicting that the first industrial resource we will get from space is beam power. That would be cool. Climate change is the greatest challenge of our time, so there's a lot at stake. From rising global temperatures to shifting weather patterns, the impacts of climate change are already felt around the globe. Overcoming this challenge will require radical changes to how we generate and consume energy. I believe that an outgoing administration in the U.S. thinks global heating or global warming is a hoax. So it's good now we're back on track. Renewable energy technologies have developed drastically in recent years with improved efficiency and lower costs. But one major barrier to their uptake is the fact that they don't provide a constant supply of energy. Wind and solar farms only produce energy when the wind is blowing or the sun is shining. But we need electricity around the clock every day. Ultimately, we need a way to store energy on a large scale before we can make the switch to renewable sources. So now, here's a subsection. It says benefits of space. A possible way around this would be to generate solar energy in space. There are many advantages to this. A space-based solar power station could orbit to face the sun 24 hours a day. The Earth's atmosphere also absorbs and reflects some of the sun's light, so solar cells above the atmosphere would receive more sunlight and produce more energy. But one of the key challenges to overcome is how to assemble, launch, and deploy such large structures. A single solar power station may have to be as much as 10 kilometers squared in areas, equivalent to 14,000 football pitches. Using lightweight materials will also be critical, as the biggest expense will be the cost of launching the station into space on a rocket. One promised solution is to develop a swarm of thousands of smaller satellites that will come together and configure to form a single large solar generator. In 2017, researchers at the California Institute of Technology outlined designs for a modular power station consisting of thousands of ultralight solar cell tiles. They also demonstrated a prototype tile weighing just 280 grams per square meter, similar to the weight of card. What is card? The weight of card. I'm not sure with that. Recently, developments in manufacturing, such as 3D printing, are also being looked at for this application. At the University of Liverpool, we are exploring new manufacturing techniques for printing ultralight solar cells onto solar sails. A solar sail is a foldable, lightweight, and highly reflective membrane capable of harnessing the effect of the sun's radiation pressure to propel a spacecraft forward without fuel. We are exploring how to embed solar cells in solar sail structures to create large, fuel-free solar power stations. These methods would enable us to construct the power stations in space. Indeed, it could one day be possible to manufacture and deploy units in space from the International Space Station on the future Lunar Gateway Station that will orbit the Moon. Such devices could, in fact, help provide power on the Moon. The possibilities don't end there. While we are currently reliant on materials from Earth to build power stations, scientists are also considering using resources from space for manufacturing, such as materials found on the Moon. Another major challenge will be getting the power transmitted back to Earth. The plan is to convert electricity from the solar cells into energy waves and use electromagnetic fields to transfer them down to an antenna on the Earth's surface. Now that would be very cool. The antenna would then convert the waves back into electricity. Researchers led by the Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency have already developed designs and demonstrated an orbiter system which should be able to do this. There is still a lot of work to be done in this field, but the aim is that solar power stations in space will become a reality in the coming decades. Researchers in China have designed a system called Omega, which they aim to have operational by 2050. This system should be capable of supplying 2 gigawatts of power into Earth's grid at peak performance, which is a high amount. To produce that much power with solar panels on Earth, you would need more than 6 million of them. Smaller solar power satellites like those designed to power lunar rovers could be operational even sooner. So it seems that if technology develops and these projects that are being developed to do things in space and to harness power in space or get materials from space, they could be super, super beneficial. I really don't think it's a waste of money. Across the globe, the scientific community is committing time and effort to the development of solar power stations in space. Our hope is that they could one day be a vital tool in our fight against climate change. This article is republished from the Conversation under a Creative Commons license, and you can go and read the original article. So again, this article is called Solar Power Stations in Space Could Be the Answer to Our Energy Needs. So what I'm going to do now, I'm going to take a little break, and when we come back, we're going to talk more AstroTalk. This is Marco. You're listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9.
Feeling lost in the lonely, meaningless cyberweb? Looking to connect with other users? Then plug in to a CITR collective. Meet users who are compatible with your interests and passions. CITR's mainframe offers 9 unique collectives: news, arts, accessibility, sports, persons of color, indigenous, gender empowerment, LGBTQ2SIA+, and music affairs. CITR collectives are where you can make great radio, great friends, and avoid the abject loneliness of life in the cyber void.
Graduate student? De-stress from your studies through the Graduate Student Society. Come and meet new friends through our beer tasting sessions, sports leagues, and fitness classes. And maybe you're interested in making a difference. Help eliminate sexual assault by volunteering to become a GSS Active Bystander Trainer. If ever you experience difficulties with your supervisors, faculty, or the university, the GSS can provide confidential advocacy assistance. And we will work with you to help resolve academic, personal, or financial issues. Your graduate student experience matters. Let the GSS help you now. Visit gss.ubc.ca.
Welcome back. This is Marco. You're listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9. So I talked a little bit about exoplanets, then I talked about harnessing or gathering power in space and transmitting it back to Earth. So the only way that these things are going to happen if money is spent on space and space research, it will benefit us. So what I do recall is a lot of these freezing techniques that they developed in space are used on Earth. And there's things like fighting cancer. They developed the techniques on Earth, and then it's transferred to other things. So there's a lot of scientific spin-off. Okay. Astronauts. Oh, this is a cool, because this is what we're waiting for. This is astronomers detect millions of signals from intelligent civilization, and the civilization is us. So this is 5 days ago. It's on livescience.com. It's by Michelle Starr. And again, the article is called Astronomers Detect Millions of Signals from Intelligent Civilization, which is us. There's an image here, the powerful 330-foot or 100-meter radio telescope at Green Bank, West Virginia. So 100 meters, it's as big as a football field. That's so cool. Would love to see something with that. It's in West Virginia. That's nice. Okay, I'm going to read the article now. The universe seems like a lonely place. We know we're proof of it. That intelligent civilizations, are possible. Finding signs of other civilizations in the Milky Way galaxy is not such a simple matter. But we do have tools at our disposal. Based on our own technological capabilities, we can extrapolate what signals alien technology might emit and search for those. These signals are called technosignatures, and our efforts in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, or SETI, revolve around them, particularly in radio wavelengths. So says astronomer Jean-Luc Margot of the University of California, Los Angeles, and quote, one of the great advantages of the search for technosignatures at radio wavelength is that we are sensitive to signals emitted from the thousands of light years away, and it does not take that much power, end quote. For instance, our search can detect the Arecibo planetary radar at distances of over 400 light years, and it can detect a transmitter that is only 1,000 times more powerful than Arecibo, a trivial improvement for an advanced civilization, all the way to the center of the galaxy, the volume of the galaxy that can be sampled with a radio search for techno signatures is immense, end quote. Margot and his team recently conducted a search for techno signatures using the Green Bank Telescope, a powerful radio telescope in West Virginia, in April of 2018 and 2019, for a total observing time of 4 hours. They homed in on 31 sun-like stars around the galactic plane, detecting a total of 26,631,913 candidate technosignatures. A closer analysis of the data revealed that every single one of those candidate technosignatures was generated right here on Earth. But the methods used to process those data are a significant step forward in identifying possible alien technosignatures, teasing them out from the background humming and pinging of anthropogenic radio noise, what we call radio frequency interference, or RFI, navigation technology, satellite technology, mobile phones, microwave ovens, aircraft, communications. We're constantly bathing our surroundings in radio frequency radiation. So says Margot again, and quote, RFI could potentially obscure an extraterrestrial signal. Our H makes our job more difficult because we detect tens of millions of signals per hour of telescope time, and we need to make a determination about every signal. Is it anthropogenic or extraterrestrial? It would be a lot easier if we detected only a few signals. Fortunately, our algorithms allow us to automatically classify over 99.8% of those signals, end quote. So I never really thought about it that they would have a lot of noise, but they do, because a lot of our signals come in there, or some noise, but I guess I wouldn't call our signals noise, but they're signals that they don't want to receive. They want extraterrestrial signals. The team made several improvements to their data processing pipeline, refining the sensitivity and signal detection rate, as well as the filter used to automatically classify RFI signals in the data and thus rule them out as alien technosignatures. As Margot noted, these filters correctly flagged 26,588,893 or 99.84% of the signals as anthropogenic RFI. When you're dealing with numbers that large, that still leaves a lot of data to process. In this case, it was 43,020 signals. The majority of these remaining signals fell within the range of known RFI and were classified accordingly. That left 4,539 signals as the most promising alien technosignature candidates. They had to be carefully visually inspected, and every single one was ultimately determined to be anthropogenic in origin. So says Margot again, end quote, if a signal is detected in multiple directions on the sky, we can be extremely confident that it's anthropogenic. An extraterrestrial signal from an emitter at interstellar distances would be detected in only one direction, end quote. So of course, if that ever happens, if signals are ever detected from an extraterrestrial race, then that would be probably the most exciting thing in our history. The result isn't unexpected. A search earlier this year of a much larger stellar sample, 10 million stars, also turned up no signs of alien technology. But that wasn't really the point, or at least not the only point. Firstly, Margot uses SETI data processing as a tool for training students at UCLA. So says Margot, and quote, we conduct the search as part of a SETI course that I have taught at UCLA annually since 2016. This course appears to be unique in the U.S. and perhaps worldwide. Students collect terabytes of data from known or suspected planetary systems, write a data processing pipeline collaboratively, search for technosignatures in the data, and publish the results. It is most satisfying to witness the students acquire important skills, all in the context of this important research. The team's refined pipeline also revealed some issues with previous attempts to process SETI data. More specifically, attempts to quantify how many transmitting civilizations there might be in the Milky Way galaxy. Their results show that these estimates may be too low by a factor of 15, partially because the data processing pipelines fail to detect some of the signals that they are designed to detect. We implemented a signal injection and recovery analysis tool that allows us to quantify the efficiency of data processing pipelines. This efficiency must be taken into account when attempting to place bounds on the number of transmitting civilizations, end quote. There are some limitations to the team's pipeline. Where two signals intersect, the algorithm only picks up the one with the highest signal-to-noise ratio. Faint signals against a high level of background noise can be missed too. This means that regions of high signal density can result in a reduction of the signal recovery rate. Overcoming these limitations could be the focus of future work, but it's work worth doing. RFI isn't just a problem for SETI, but for all radio astronomers, so much so that some measurements can no longer be made from Earth. And scientists are eyeing the far side of the moon for a radio telescope. The moon acts as a natural buffer against anthropogenic radio interference. And of course, there's the possibility, slight but not zero, that we might detect something. So says Margot again, and quote, "The search may answer one of the most profound scientific questions of our time. Are we alone? All life on Earth is related to a common ancestor, and the discovery of another form of life will revolutionize our understanding of living systems. On a more philosophical level, it will transform our perception of humanity's place in the cosmos. This research has been accepted into the Astronomical Journal and is available on ARXIV." So that was a nice article, and I guess I have a bit of envy for these people, because to me, like, for example, detecting radio signals or searching for ground dwarfs, things like that, or piloting a spacecraft. So, for example, the Cassini mission that had to be, you know, receives its signals from Earth. So imagine being in charge of that. The other day, last night on the show, I listened to it. It also talked about when the European Space Agency sent a Philae lander to land on Cherkasov, Gerasimov 67P, the comet. I hope I said that right. I probably said it wrong. But they detected a lot of things, a lot of atoms and stuff that are the telltale signs of life. Doesn't mean that life is there, but all the amino acids, all the chemicals are all there, and it's possible that this show said, Brian Cox seems to think that life evolved in a pool of water in Australia like 3 or 4 billion years ago, but these scientists were holding out the theory that it's possible that these life existed on these comets, and when these comets and asteroids hit Earth, they brought life here. So who knows? But let's go on. So now we're going to talk about the Blue Ring Nebula. So I went to a star watching party once. It was close to the U.S. border, and there were people with a lot of telescopes there, with nice big telescopes, people with a lot of really good knowledge, and you could go from telescope to telescope, and they would image things, and you could see them. So I saw star clusters, planets, different nebulas. It was really cool. So having a telescope can be probably one of the funnest things you can one of the funnest hobbies that you can take part in. But again, like, taking the telescope out, putting it in your car, taking it out, setting it up, and all this takes time. So what I did remember when I was living in another part of the city, I would put my telescope out for a little while, because I read that you had to, when your telescope is inside your house, it's warmed up. So you got to put it outside for a while to get it acclimated to the temperature, to the outside of temperature, and it can make your viewing better. So there's a lot of little things you got to take care of when you're viewing things on telescopes, or when you're, when you're trying to see things, you're an astronomer. So now here is an article on space.com. It's called "The Dazzling Blue Ring Nebula Puzzled Scientists for 16 Years, and Now They Finally Understand Why." So one nebula I have seen is the Ryan Nebula. It's very beautiful. You can see it on a clear night. You can use your telescope or your binoculars. It's very beautiful. It's got this glowy green, and this is called the Blue Ring Nebula. So it says here, this Blue Ring Nebula puzzled astronomers for 16 years, and now they finally understand why. This is an article that's on LiveScience.com. It was 6 days ago. So it is on the 18th of November by Samantha Mathewson. So again, the Dazzling Blue Ring Nebula puzzled astronomers for 16 years, and now they finally understand why. Scientists have uncovered new evidence in the mysterious fluorescent debris of the Blue Ring Nebula that may explain how the strange structure formed. The Blue Ring Nebula harbors a central star known as TYC2597-735-1. I'd like to know what TYC stands for. An unusual ultraviolet ring surrounds the star. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to take this, I'm going to copy it, and then I'm going to paste it into the search and see what it turns up. What is this TYC? So, oh, there we go. And hopefully, okay, what is TYC? It's not doing it. Hang on. Sorry about that. I'll try once again. It's not working. Okay, so sorry about that. There we go. Well, maybe it'll work now, hopefully. Come on, please. Work. Okay, anyway. Okay. An unusual ultraviolet ring surrounds a star, which astronomers first observed in 2004 using NASA's now-defunct Galaxy Evolution Explorer. Sorry, I'm making noise. I'm trying to find something. I'm trying to make my computer work. Oh, the defunct Galaxy Evolution Galax Space Telescope. Until now, the formation of this peculiar ring, probably spectacular too, which is actually invisible ultraviolet light that has been coded blue in the telescope images, has largely remained a mystery. So hopefully I can get this going now. Let's see, I'm trying to see what TY, it's not cooperating with me, and I don't know why. So it is not doing what I wanted to do. Okay, I'll give up. So says Mark Siebert, an astrophysicist with the Carnegie Institution for Science and a member of the Galax team and co-author and a new researcher. And quote, every time we thought we had this thing figured out, something would tell us, now that's not right. That's a scary thing as a scientist, but I also love how unique this object is and the efforts that so many people put in to figure it out, end quote. Using the W.M. Keck Observatory in Hawaii, researchers found that the blue ring is actually the base of a cone-shaped cloud of glowing molecular hydrogen that extends far from the central star toward Earth. The new observations also show a second cone-shaped cloud that extends from the star in the opposite direction. So let's read that again. Researchers found that the blue ring is actually the base of a cone-shaped cloud of glowing molecular hydrogen that extends away from the central star towards Earth. The new observations also show a second cone-shaped cloud that extends from the star in the opposite direction. So there's one cloud, cone-shaped, of glowing molecular hydrogen that extends towards Earth, and another second cone that extends from the star in the opposite direction. Let's see if there's an image here. It had an image, but the image is not coming up, so something's going wrong here. Because I would have liked to seen what it looked like. So there's an image, but the image is not appearing. Okay, the bases of the cone-shaped clouds appear to overlap when viewed from Earth, creating the ring shaped around the star. Christopher Martin, a physicist at California Institute of Technology, Caltech, said in a news conference November 17. The scientists behind the new researchers believe that the cloud of fluorescent debris formed around a sun-like star collided with and consumed a smaller stellar companion only a few thousand years ago. Now that's a blink of an eye in astronomical terms. The recent observations capture a never-before-seen evolutionary phase of stellar collision. So this is all about a stellar collision. I think that would be cool to see. So says Carrie Hoadley, lead author of the study and a physicist of Caltech, and quote, the merging of two stars is fairly common, but they quickly become obscured by lots of dust as the ejecta from them expands and cools in space, which means we can't see what actually happened, end quote. The timing of the new observations was critical in helping scientists understanding the phenomena. So says Don Neal, an astrophysicist at Caltech and Galax team member, and quote, it's like catching sight of a baby when it first walks. If you blink, you might miss it, end quote. It was that timing that let the researchers really see what was going on. Hoadley said, and quote, we think this object represents a late stage of these transient events, when the dust finally clears and we have a good view. But we also caught the process before it was too far along. After time, the nebula will dissolve into the interstellar medium, and we would not be able to tell anything happened at all. End quote. The stellar collision ejected a cloud of hot debris into space. As the debris flew outward, it created a shock wave that, in turn, heated up hydrogen molecules in the debris cloud, producing the ultraviolet emission scientists first observed back in 2004. The researchers also used archive data from NASA's Spitzer Space Telescope and the Wide Field Survey Explorer, WISE, which revealed an excess of infrared emissions around the central star of the Blue Ring Nebula. These observations suggest that the star is surrounded by a disk of dust that absorbs the star's light and then re-radiates in the infrared. The researchers believe that this disk cut the debris cloud surrounding the star in half, creating the two cone-shaped clouds that extend in opposite directions. The findings were published November 18th in the journal Nature. So that's too bad that there's no photo of this, but the article is called "The Dazzling Blue Ring Nebula Puzzled Scientists for 16 Years, and Now They Finally Understand Well Why." So thank you for listening. This is Marco. You've been listening to Astro Talk. We'll talk to you next week on this same radio station. Goodbye.